And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville.
Baseball Hall of Famer Jason Stark.
And then the robot said, strike.
That's why you're going in the Hall of Fame.
It's an inside the park home run, Doug Glanville.
Mike Trout is coffee. At Starbucks with a double latte, skinny.
Doug, are you ready to make some podcast magic?
I am ready. Bring on the magic wand. Let's do it.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville. I'm Jason Stark. I write about baseball for The Athletic. And I am joined, once again, by my good friend, writer, broadcaster, professor, distinguished former major leaguer, and the voice of Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN Radio, Doug Glanville.
Yes.
Doug, you're here.
I'm just doing hand gestures now. You know, I figure we're on video now and we could do signs stealing third. Yeah, I'm here. I'm going for it, man. That's it. I'm often in a different state, like hours before this. It's really cool.
It's almost like there was some invention that would allow you to get from one state to another state in just a few hours. That's a really handy invention for somebody like you, because if you listen to this show regularly, what do you know about Doug? He's doing the show on no sleep. Doug has just climbed off yet another red eye. He was in Arizona Sunday night with ESPN. So, Doug, I was thinking about this. I would like you to give people one tip, just one now, for surviving flying overnight through the sky and then functioning when you get off the magic thing that takes you there. So just one, okay? So something meaningful can come from this other than you leading the league in sleep deprivation.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I talk to my colleagues at ESPN all the time during these games, and I insist that we need to write a book about like travel stories from broadcaster land or something, because it's hilarious.
Yeah.
I want to make a note that Eduardo Perez, and he says Perez, but it's Perez, but you know, he says Perez, you know, I'm working on that.
Right.
But I'm going to say Eduardo Perez, and he is in the Million Mile Club for I forgot what airline. It is amazing. That's we should all aspire to that if we're in this industry, because it's like concierge. So that's one way to make it easy. You know, almost get to the level where you're practically your own private jet. Since that's not going to happen for most of us, it's not going to happen for me certainly. You know, the tidbit I say is this: put your phone away, because if you get your phone out, you're going to be tempted to watch some sort of movie, and it's going to cut into your sleep. You have to get on the plane, completely go to sleep right away, ignore everybody around you, put on a hoodie like I do, like this, right? That's it. Disappear and capture every minute of sleep you can. I invest in an incredible pillow, whatever it takes, and then make sure you sleep. Don't fight it. Don't try to get food. Don't get snacks. Just shut down. And then you might get like 4 hours, because of course there's no nonstops to Hartford. I mean, barely. So I got to connect somewhere. So my rule of thumb, if there's two legs, I take the first one as long as possible so I can get sleep on that one. And then, you know, by then it's like 6, 7 a.m. and then I just, you know, fly home. So today was, I don't even know where I was. Phoenix, yes. So I was in Phoenix. Yeah. And then I went straight to Atlanta, got my sleep, boom, home. You know, so I try to do that. Now, a lot of guys try to split the bait, you know, come in the middle of the, nope, don't do that. Don't do the 2.5, 2.5. You'll never get any sleep. That's a mistake. And then don't get too close to your city, because then you get like the small plane and it's all a mess and you don't get that. No, you got to go like, you got to be about 2 hours away and you got to fly like 4+ hours and accept the extra hour because that's sleep. And that's about the best I can do. I feel pretty good. I slept the whole way. And I will collapse because it's not the first day that hits you. It's the second day. That's what gets you.
That's right.
And then I start to speak in German at this point because I don't know what I'm saying. So that's it. Tidbits from me. That's my travelogue. Yeah.
Okay. Here's my little tip for you. Always try to remember where you are. Okay. Like you didn't seem to have any recollection of the fact that you were in Phoenix. Okay. I think that's a problem because if you don't remember where you were, it means you might not remember where you're going, and that can cause all kinds of problems. Okay, so wherever you're going, go there. Okay, don't go to some other place. That's another travel tip for you from Starkville. Okay, all right, and I have more good news. The season's almost over, which means for Doug Glanville, the red-eye season is also almost over. Hey, Doug, I'm not sure if you heard about this, but the Red Sox were in the news last week for doing that thing they do every 3 or 4 years, always in the middle of the season. They let go another guy who was running their baseball operation, this time Chaim Bloom, former guest of ours. Chaim had quite a run of 1,417 days, and nobody that I know had more of a sense of where it all went wrong for him than our friend Dan Shaughnessy, the legendary columnist for the Boston Globe. So let's welcome him to Starkville. Dan, thanks for joining us, my friend.
Anything for you, Jason. How you doing?
Great, buddy. Hey, listen, Dan, when the Red Sox announced that they had canned Chaim, that was what, last Thursday afternoon, one of the first things I thought of was, I cannot wait to read Dan Shaughnessy tomorrow. And as always, you didn't disappoint. So let's talk about that column. You wrote something that I've heard you say and write before, that Chaim was not ready or equipped to run a big market team. So here's a loaded question. What gave you that impression?
Well, first of all, I really like Chaim Bloom, and he'll work again, and he'll be good. I just think he wasn't ready for this particular job yet, and he was put in an impossible situation. So those things worked against him, and those things really aren't his fault. But, you know, there was a misconception locally that he ran the Rays and he was responsible for everything the Rays did. He was not. He was of the Rays. He came into baseball with that, but he didn't run the Rays, and I'm not sure he should be running anything in terms of running a department in Major League Baseball team, especially in a big market with all the walls closed in like you have around here. At the end, he was indecisive. I mean, that's something you can't be. He was never a big, bold thinker. He was slow to pull the trigger. Other teams got fed up with that. They weren't waiting around. We'll go somewhere else. You know, dealing with 29 teams. Yeah. And that was not a good trait that we were unaware of, you know, when he got the job. And they didn't do a lot of diligence on this hire. It was done quickly. And I don't really know why, but he did what they asked him to do, which is drive down the payroll. They went from 1 to 13 in payroll, and then he rebuilt the farm system. You know, Dave had traded a lot of guys. Dave didn't trade many guys that turned out to be good, in fairness to Dave. But right. I think the system was rated low. And the one thing about Chaim rebuilding the system, they still don't have any pitchers in that system that's ranked so high. I think Baseball America's got them up to 5, but there's no pitchers in that system that are a threat to help them. And the people that are on the team contributing were all Dave guys. Duran, Bayo, Casas, they're all Dave guys, including Raffaella, the guy they just called up, all brought in under Dubrowski during his regime. So anyway, Chaim's put in this position, and the first thing that you got to trade Mookie Betts. Well, that's not his fault. He would not have chosen to do that. That was a mandate. He did it, and he didn't get enough. And they kind of had a gun to his head. There wasn't a lot of teams that would afford that. He had to put Price in the deal to have them take some salary there. And I came away with, you know, one guy who's already been released, and then Connor Wong, who looks like a career, maybe a 240 hitter, who's, you know, a smallish catcher, who's okay. And and average Al Verdugo, as we call him, you know, who the manager can't stand, and I believe will be traded, you know, because he's just, it won't end well. You know, he's got skills. I like some of what he does. You know, he chokes up for one thing. I love that. But but yeah, you know, just hasn't been the dynamic player that you need to get when you trade Mookie Betts. So all those things worked against Heim. But again, a good and decent guy who will be an asset, be a farm director, analytics operative, whatever, and, you know, work his way back into a position that he had here.
Yeah, look, we'll run through all of that in a little more detail, but let me ask you about the good and decent guy part. You know, Heim once told me that you and he had a very cordial relationship, other than the part where you thought he was over his head running the baseball team, right? So I've never actually asked you about that. What was your relationship like with Heim?
I've talked to my wife about this just down the kitchen a little bit ago. I mean, the guy is, I really like him. Yeah. And, you know, he lives pretty nearby. He's got little kids that play ball. My grandsons are in the same league with him. He would send me a text and say, I heard you were scouting the Giants and Padres today. And it was the Giants Pirates, like T-ball and fall ball here in Newton, you know, and just, you know, never took anything personal. That's hard to do. It can't be any fun to be on the other end of our stuff. And I understand that. And, you know, I mean, I go back, you know, Lou Gorman, Dan Duquette, you know, Theo, Ben, Dave, you know, and it's very hard not to personalize that. It would piss me off. I wouldn't like it. I understand that, but he never took it personally. And Jason, I really believe the level of his devotion to his religion, I believe he cannot tell a lie. And that's unusual in the business. And I mean, when he made the best trade at the press conference, I said, well, okay, welcome to Boston. You just traded Mookie Betts. So you think you're going to be worse this year? And he said, yeah, we'll probably be worse. I mean, you don't put that on bumper stickers for the campaign for the 2020 season, but it was honest and it was true. And they were worse. They went right to last place. So I love that kind of honesty. And you could tell when you had him on something he didn't want to reveal, he would be appropriately evasive, but I believe he never lied to us. And I mean, even Lou Gorman did that. Lou was a greater guy than Lou Gorman. Yeah, got a lie in the job. I mean, they all do it.
Lou was not going to tell you what he had for lunch. That's for sure.
Yeah. So, well, Dan, I mean, you know, I want to sort of ask about the narrative about, you know, not having, you know, being prepared for a certain kind of market. And I'm going to use Jay Bruce as an example. You know, Jay Bruce was at the Mets, you know, towards the end of his career, and he was struggling. And then he kind of went off saying, you know, I'm tired of people saying, you know, I can't play in New York. And, you know, it's like sometimes he just doesn't align. And would it be different if Heim Bloom, like, finished strong and got to the postseason this year and, you know, made it to the ALCS or whatever? So I guess what is it about that kind of narrative about, like, the formula around being able to survive a certain kind of market? Like, and how do you kind of underscore that, you know, sometimes it's just the timing and the circumstances and the market. Like, I played in Philadelphia and I'm a pretty low-key guy. And it's like, but, you know, it's like, so I'm just curious if you could speak to that.
No, it's a good question, and it's relevant to what you guys are doing here. I mean, Philadelphia, much like Boston, is very personal here, you know, and it makes it difficult. So when you're in this market, they're not about to stand, and they don't want to be told it's a rebuilding year ever, because, you know, it's a big market and the funds are there. So there's no excuse, you know, to have, you know, and Theo learned his lesson the hard way. Theo, to 1 year, told us, I think it was going into 10, it was going to be a bridge year. And he will never use that word again, ever. I mean, it's a local joke now, but he did use it at the winter meetings and just got annihilated for the bridge year. And that's why in 11, they went out and they stocked, but they got Gonzalez, they got Crawford. They loaded up, thought they had the greatest team of all time because they were not going to, like, have the fans push back or have the media push back on a bridge year. You can't get away with that in this market. No one's in a mood for patience or rebuilding. And it's just created a kind of a tough, making the seat even hotter. And of course, now they're going to finish last for the third time in 4 years and the sixth time in 12 years. Those are the numbers I use. I mean, they use, we've won four championships in this century more than anybody else. That's true. But the pivot after the 18th season is serious. And, I mean, no team has finished last. They are the major league leaders. and finishing last in the last 12 years, the Boston Red Sox.
Amazing. Hey, look, before we get into the really meaty stuff here, I've got a question that's been on my mind. Why do the Red Sox do every firing in the middle of the season, always on game day? Can they fire Dave Dombrowski during a game, Ben Sherrington during a game? Ron Renneke was the manager in between the two Alex Cora stints. He was getting ready to do his meeting with the media before the game and got banged. So, like, what is up with that? Is this to create must-see Nesson programming or something?
Well, I think, you know, see, Dave, don't forget, Dave, they won like 118 games in 2018, you know, and right. and Dave wanted some clarity about his situation. I had written Dave's in trouble because they only won like 84 or 86 in 2019, and they had the highest payroll in baseball. And Dave had signed Sale to the five-year, $150 million contract right before he needed Tommy John surgery. So you had all, you know. So it wasn't a swell summer here in 2019. And Dave, I wrote, he's in trouble. And it sounded ridiculous because they just won 118 games, whatever it was. They had one of the dominant teams in history in 2018. And Dave, it was a double. It was a Yankee game. I think it was a Sunday or Monday night. It was a big NFL game on. We were all down for the Patriot opener. And I think Dave pounded his fist and said he wanted some clarity in the situation. So he got it. You know, he got the clarity he was looking for. And he packed up his stuff and left in mid-game. That's how that one happened. The Ben one, I can't remember. It was 2015. And you know, they had won in 13. They won the World Series and then finished last in 14 and 15. And John Farrell had cancer. It was a very messy situation, that one. But, you know, John Henry, in my view, there's some disinterest at the top. They don't care about it as much as they did. They do care about perceptions. They care about making money. And you got Tom Warner, who's kind of a needy figure, as you all know, and wants to inject himself into it. And so they do these things. But none of the guys you just mentioned have lasted a full 4 years. They all were gone in the fourth year, couldn't quite make it to the finish line. And the Heim thing, this one was, there's been some bad optics the last 3 weeks. You know, they did nothing at the deadline again. That was problematic because I think they were a game and a half or two from the wild card at that point. You know, the illusion of contention, which they love here, that went away. And they've just been – and then the Mets came in and took over Fenway with their fans, and the Braves came in and took over Fenway with their fans. The Dodgers came in and took over Fenway. That never used to happen here, Jason. You know that.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that was embarrassing to them. And they had that weird game with Bearclaw, the kid who was pitching in the Pioneer League, and they actually gave up on a game in which they were leading. Against Houston, the team that was directly ahead of them. And Alex had no pitching, and he made it very clear by leaving this guy in to take one of the great beatdowns in history. And they were ahead of the second inning he was pitching when they gave up and didn't put anybody in the bullpen as 10 or 11 or 12 runs were scored. I mean, it was remarkable. They were leading the game, and they were two games behind Houston in the wild card.
Right, and so nobody warmed up, right?
There was no. There was no – and Alex basically told the world, this is what they're giving me tonight. I got nobody, you know, short of putting Trevor Story on the mound or something. And I'm going to show you all. And that's what he did. And I think it came down to kind of, it's either me or Hein. They're both going into the last year of the contract. I think the culmination of those embarrassments led up to it. But I will tell you this, Jason. I mean, the timing of it was even worse. It was the eve of the Jewish high holidays, which I'm not totally versed in, but I got a lot of pushback from readers.
That's a good point.
And it was Thursday, and I mean, I'm not equipped to explain the gravitas of the holiday situation. But and for a guy who's as devout as Heim is, I mean, and where's Tom Warner on that one? Like, he didn't notice. Tom was in the meeting when they did this. Where's Tom?
Wow. Yeah, I wasn't even going to go there, but
I did. I haven't. It hasn't really been written. I might get a paragraph in this weekend, but I mean, yeah, I got a lot of pushback from my readers went there. I can tell you that.
Oh, I can imagine. You know, like there's a lot to get into with just Heim himself, but I mean, you've talked a lot about ownership, so we should do that. Okay. Before we do, do you need to mention that John Henry also owns your newspaper, or do you want me to take care of that?
I mean, we mentioned it every time, every column of the year. It's like it's one of the it's an unprecedented situation in the history of journalism that the man who owns the team owns the paper. It's usually the other way around. We've had that in Chicago with the Cubs and, you know, the TV station with the Braves and all that. But in other situations, the media outlet owned the team. Basically, in this case, the team owns the media outlet.
Yeah.
And that's what we've got here. And it never goes away. And it was a stunning development that happened in 2013. And, you know, it's not been a party starter in my office or at my house. It's because it puts everybody in an awkward position where there's a conflict of interest that's inherent and you can't get around it or deny it. So we confront it every time we mentioned who also owns the Globe, et cetera. But, you know, it's super awkward for me. I've never been really in favor with ownership. And then when Francona got fired, I did the book with Francona, which I think he didn't even like me that much. But I think hiring me to be the co-author scared the hell out of them. And I think that that's what he was looking for. And because when I reached out to Terry and said, hey, sorry you got fired, you want to do a book together? He said, no, and not with you, you know. And but he came around when they started to, you know, the bad things came out that were planted in the media about him and his personal stuff and all that. And he got very angry. And I think I served a purpose at that point moving forward. And then after that, while the book was in production, John bought the team. I bought the Globe, excuse me. John Henry bought the Globe while that book was in production.
Wow. Timing.
At which point, you know, I called the IT department to come. It was like the first scene of Argo when they're breaking the hard drives and shredding documents and barricading your office. That was me at the Globe when John bought the Globe.
Okay, so Dan, you're under arrest. But assuming that the door doesn't get broken down while we're talking, we'll keep going through this.
Thank you.
So,
looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Did John Henry and Tom Werner overreact to Dave Dombrowski? I mean, Doug played in Philadelphia. I still live in Philadelphia, as everyone knows. The owner in Philly, John Middleton, loves Dave. He's empowered Dave to do what Dave loves to do. Not just spend money, but build a team of stars and in a related development with star power that the town loves. Okay, so what was it about the Dave Dombrowski method of GMing that the Red Sox owners hated so much that they had to fire him less than a year after they won the World Series?
Well, again, I think the sale contract came up in the spring of 19. So Sale gets the last out of the World Series. The strikeout of Machado cost them $150 million. You know, Sale came out of the bullpen and struck out the side because Kimbrel had just was so nervous he couldn't be used in those situations. And so Sale ended up being the guy who finished the World Series. Famous picture, Machado's down on one knee. Everybody here loved that. It was a great thing. And then in the spring, and Sale had, if you go back and look at Sale numbers in 18, it was declining. It was very obvious to everyone that this was going the wrong way. And they've gotten, I mean, it's not Strasburg level, but it's gotten no yield for this five-year deal because the deal didn't go into effect until 20. He was already signed for 19, and he did a few things that year, but it was now useless. Anyway, and I think that they held that against Dave and said, why are we spending, you know, In 19, they said, why do we have the top payroll in all of baseball and we're not making the playoffs? Tom Werner said this. They pivoted in 19, and Tom Werner at the press conference, which was a couple weeks after they fired Dave, said, you know, we've looked at this, and their team's spending half as much that are in the playoffs. And that's what they want to become, a team that spends half as much and has the illusion of contention every year because there's seven teams are going, and that's what they want to be now.
Well, can you talk about Alex Cora in all this? Because, you know, all right, you know, he's going to stay. There's a sort of interview process. Obviously, a lot of controversy was swirling around everything that happened in Houston. And yet, you know, he sort of, you know, he outlasts, you know, Chaim Bloom. And I mean, where does he fit in this equation, just understanding the Red Sox point of view or how they're operating?
Well, that's a very important part of it, Doug. And because, you know, Alex is not going to badmouth anybody, but the signs were there that it was kind of either me or him kind of thing. You know, Chaim said they were underdogs at the deadline. Nobody wants to hear the Red Sox are underdogs because of the sources they have here and the attendance they have and everything. And Alex started wearing an underdogs T-shirt around the clubhouse and whatnot. And the messages he sent in those give up games, you know, the Bear Claw game, and there was another one against Kansas City. They were down 13-1, and Alex did the same thing. So the messages were there, I think, and they were both going into the last year. But what's weird about this is that, you know, there's certainly an undercurrent of Alex eventually being in the front office, either with them or someone else. So it's not out of the realm that he could succeed Chaim. I don't think that's going to happen, nor do I think it should. I think he's great in the dugout, sees a lot of things, players respect him, and I think he's a really good manager. I think he should have been up for manager of the year, having these guys over 500 all year, in my view. I mean, it just was a team not built to win, one of the worst defensive base running teams you'll ever see. And they had him 9 games over at one point. So I think he's really good in the dugout. But he won this power struggle, in my view, and that gives him some gravitas. And he wants pitching this offseason, and they're going to have to spend for it. So that's what's so interesting about who they bring in and what the philosophy is going to be, because they don't have prospects to give up. Well, I mean, they do have prospects to give up, but the MO has been can't touch any of these guys. And they don't have any pitching prospects. They're going to have to pay for pitching. And that's what Alex Cora wants them to do. So that's going to be interesting how much power he has as he goes to this offseason.
Yeah. Hey, I want to circle back to Mookie. You know, I was actually in Boston for one of those Peter Gammons hot stove cool music extravaganzas when that trade went down. And it was incredible to be around people who cared about the Red Sox in that moment in time, because that deal, as you know, hit everyone like Aaron Boone's homer, you know?
Yeah.
And so then Mookie comes back and plays baseball in Fenway for the first time since the trade, right? Comes back as a returning hero. And it felt like it didn't just remind everyone of how great a baseball player he was. It reminded everyone sitting in that park that the team they care about didn't do what it took to hold on to a player like that. And I mean, as you've said, Chaim was ordered to make that trade, but in some way, can we connect the dots from Mookie's return and that atmosphere over those 3 days to this firing?
It was a very embarrassing weekend for them. You know, oddly, the first game of that series, Mookie's first game back, was one of those goofy, either Peacock or some network. It wasn't on their network. So they have all these people paying $1 billion for their extra cable package to get Nesson. And then the games, and, you know, the old people don't pay attention. We try to tell them there's not going to be a game on this Friday night.
Right.
When you turn it on, it won't be there. You know, you can never train the regular viewers, and I'm one of them. Get ready. That's not going to be on. And it was the Friday night Mookie game when he came back, and they're like, now it looks like you're hiding something. Like, no one's going to notice, you know. And Jason, you'll like that. We call that the wrecking ball tour. I mean, Mookie came in, he got like 100 hits in the 3 games. I mean, he was throwing guys out from right field, and it was like it was a tour de force, you know, the whole weekend. And it really sent them into a spiral from which they've not recovered. I mean, that was it. And national TV on Sunday night, the whole thing, it was delicious. So, yeah, I think your point is well taken. And the Dodger fans took over that weekend because Fenway fans kind of either gave up and sold their tickets or didn't go, whatever. And it was a, you know, I never heard Fenway in that much in favor of the visitors as it was that weekend.
Amazing. And it was the Dodgers. I'm not sure that making trades was Haim's thing. Teams didn't like dealing with him. You know, it seemed like he viewed every trade discussion as an equity exchange. And I've always felt, not just about him, if you look at baseball trades that way, you would never do anything because sometimes you have to overpay, or at least you have to give up more than you would prefer to give up. Is that an accurate depiction of Haim in those moments?
From all the feedback that we hear, yes, and that teams got tired of it. I thought he should have. I said sell at the deadlines, you know, trade Paxton. Paxton had value at the deadline. He was left-handed. He was come back. He had a nice run of starts. Someone would have given up for him. Duval, Turner. I mean, these guys aren't going to be part of the next period of success of the Red Sox. And they had value at that time. And I believe, he got paralyzed by that. And I think that's part of it. There is one. Go back. The Vasquez one, which he got hammered for, the trade in Vasquez, in the deadline the year before.
Right.
The guy Abreu they got in that is pretty good, I think. He's 24 years old. He's Venezuelan. He's an outfielder, and he's not like all their touted guys, Casas, Duran, but I think Haim's legacy, that's an everyday player. I think he's pretty good. I like him a lot. And he got him in the Vasquez deal. And, of course, I don't pay attention like you guys do to these prospects and stuff. I didn't know. But subsequently, I'm like, hey, Haim left that guy behind. Abreu's pretty good. So maybe in retrospect, he'll be viewed better on that one. But I think you're right. There was a concept of winning the deal. You know, I mean, Belichick does that. He hoards all these fourth-round picks, and he's got to, you know, Danny Ainge did that, too. You got to win the deal. And as you say, you can have deals where both teams win, and it's good for everybody.
So, Dan, do you see the elements of Haim Bloom we talked about, like the good man, in terms of how he tried to, you know, address culture around Major League Baseball, you know, through the Boston Red Sox, you know, because he was also, you know, at the helm with George Floyd, you know, a whole lot of things were happening in our country. And he did some things that were also very kind of bold, right? He outlined some of the incidents that happened at Fenway Park. He put it on, you know, social media, put a big Black Lives Matter sign over the Mass Pike. And so you think those elements will stay? You know, could this be part of his legacy that's kind of invisible in the shadows a little bit because of the fact that, you know, we focus on the X's and O's on the field? But Haim definitely tried to take a social consciousness to his work.
He definitely did. He's all about that. I don't think he'll get any credit for that as a legacy. I think ownership kind of steps in. And in fairness, I believe ownership, you know, was every bit, if not more, sensitive to those issues. I think the Red Sox ownership, they come up very big in this area. I think as much as I go at them about certain things, I think that they're strong. I think, you know, Sam Kennedy, you know, John Tom, you know, yeah, I mean, when Adam Jones had issues at Fenway Park and stuff, I think ownership backed him in a big way and owned it and talked to their own players and said, what are you guys hearing? You know, this guy's not making it up, is he? And no. And you know, you get pushed back on the radio shows and all the stuff around here. But I thought that the franchise stood tall in that moment and that Haim was certainly part of it. But he'll never get credit for that. His best bet is Abreu and guys like that. And the farm system, if these guys, you know, I mean, they got Mayer, the shortstop, you know, supposedly on the rise, and he was a number four pick. And when those guys get to the big leagues, he'll get credit for those things. I don't think he'll get credit for the stuff you've mentioned, but it's certainly he was a very big part of that because, again, such a good guy.
Dan, let's look into the future, okay? What do we see moving forward? I know one thing. Theo isn't coming back, okay?
Nope.
And a lot of the names that I saw thrown out there felt very Haim-like, to be honest. And, you know, the first rule of baseball hirings and firings is when you fire one manager or one general manager, you hire the opposite.
Right.
But who is that? Jeff Lunau?
Right. They've done that since Theo left. You know, I mean, well, Ben was kind of a Theo, but then Dave was the opposite of Ben. And then Haim was the opposite of Dave. So it's sort of, you'd go back to, like you say, go back to the Dave type. That's not happening. No one's going to have that kind of unilateral ability to spend money, trade prospects. That's over. here. They're not getting back to that. So I don't know what they will get back to. And that's what's so intriguing about this. You know, some of the names, Antonetti's name that comes out there, and, you know, everybody has so much respect for him, but he's worked with Terry Francona for 12 years, and Tito just loves him. I can't imagine that after everything he's heard from Tito, he's coming here.
I agree.
Well, man, yeah. Tito may retire at some point or whatever. However he comes off the field. So that might be what it takes.
Yeah, we're going to miss him. Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah, we're going to have him on the next edition of this show. So,
oh God, tell him hello. I love him. He's the greatest. We could tell Tito stories all day.
Yeah, we could.
Because he's got his Philly history.
Yeah, like he was my neighbor when he lived here. So that was quite a thing.
Can I digress and give you one Tito story since we have a Philly connection?
Absolutely.
Here? Do you know the one about when they win the World Series So they win the World Series in 04, and, you know, he's never gets over his Philly years because, you know, they slash his tires and fan appreciation day. And, you know, he couldn't even go back and scout behind the backstop and all stuff like that. It's just, you know, it's hilarious. And, you know, of course, he's a Pennsylvania guy and the whole thing. So he's driving to spring training, as he always does, in 05. And he's on 95 barreling down toward Fort Myers. And he starts seeing all these, you know, SUVs and Winnebagos festooned with Eagles flags and stuff. And they're driving north. They're going the other way. And he realizes they've just left Jacksonville to drive home from the Super Bowl where the Patriots got them. You know, the Patriots beat them. So he starts flipping them off, you know, as he's heading south and they're heading north. He realizes, oh, he's going to contribute to their sadness that they just lost the Super Bowl, and now he's getting them back one last time, you know, in a very mature fashion. So yeah, ask him that; he'll verify that. It was great.
Okay, for sure. How'd that work out for him? All right. Hey, I've got one final idea for you before we let you go. Let's hire you to be the next chief baseball officer of the Boston Red Sox. You have all the money that you want to sign anybody you want. Okay, I'll talk to John Henry. This is no problem. But realistically, you can only sign one free agent. So who are you signing? Is it Aaron Nola, Blake Snell, Eduardo Rodriguez, or that Shohei Ohtani guy?
Well, I understand Ohtani's probably not going to be a consequential pitcher. I'm not counting on that. I'm still signing him just because of the PR that it brings and the message to your fans that it brings. And they need that. They need to show to the fans that ownership cares about them and values them and will. They used to be in the conversation when the best guys came forward, whether it was Curt Schilling or Pedro, Manny Ramirez, that goes back to Duquette. You know, when A-Rod was available, they actually acquired him for a few days in 2003. You know, so when the biggest names came up, they were serious and they would get them. I mean, Johnny Damon a couple years earlier, big name free agents. And that was the Red Sox. You always in the conversation for that top talent. Keith Folk, the best reliever on the market, got him. They were players, and that's what they need to be. And Ohtani sends that message, even if he doesn't pitch again, whatever. And just the goodwill that would bring, and they really need that because they've got some young players, and I just think their image and their relevance in the market has really taken a hit, and I'm sad to see that because, you know, I'm a ball guy going back to the '60s, and I don't want to see the Sox, you know, kind of fizzle out in this market here. They're too important.
Okay, so there you go. Who should be the Red Sox next chief baseball officer? It's Dan Shaughnessy. Vote for Dan Shaughnessy. Yeah. He's signing Ohtani. Yeah. John Henry's already paying him. It's perfect.
Yeah, I don't think it would work because you have to talk to each other, and that's not happened. So, it'd be tough, you know.
Right. Hey, Dan, we'll talk to you anytime, okay?
Yeah, you always come here. So awesome. Always come here.
This was fun. That's all I got. Enjoy being with you guys.
Likewise. Look, let's do it again sometime. Maybe after the next Red Sox firing in the middle of the game day.
4 years from now, and they fire the next guy, we'll come back on to it again.
Okay. It's a date. Thank you, Dan.
See you guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Dan. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. It's that time again. It is time for listener trivia. our way of involving you, our favorite listeners, in this show. Doug, you know what? We are running out of time this month to get a question before the end of the month. We have not been shut out in a single month all season. Are you getting worried at all?
Well, a little bit, but I feel like we made a good trade to the trade deadline, and we have a lot of good relief pitching now. So we're good.
We are. Okay, good to know. Because I'm thinking today might be the day. We have a fun question, but I think we have a shot at it. So why don't we welcome in this week's special trivia guest star here to the Starkville Trivia Emporium. It is Nick Pierce. Nick, welcome to Starkville. It is great to have you here.
Hey, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we're very happy to have you on. And judging by that cap you're wearing, I'm going to guess shrewdly that you're in Arizona and you're like an Arizona-type sports fan. Is that right?
Yeah, that'd be correct. Born and raised in Phoenix. I actually just moved to Kansas City. And I probably am one of the few people to fly an Arizona Diamondbacks flag outside my house in Kansas City. So if you see that, you know that's probably me.
Okay, it's a great conversation starter, I'm sure. Let me ask you, who are you feeling better about these days, the Arizona Diamondbacks or those Arizona football Cardinals?
Man,
trick question.
yeah. Without Kyler, I think Diamondbacks are all the way in this year. Hopefully, they can nip a wild card spot. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, they're in good position right now. How about that? Who saw that coming? All right, that's enough of this chit chat. Nick, time for you to hit us with your question. Are you ready?
All right, guys. So since 1996, the year Doug debuted, there have been four pitchers who have reached 2,000 strikeouts and won a World Series MVP. Can you name them?
Can we name them? I think we can. So we need four pitchers who won a World Series MVP award and got to 2,000 strikeouts. Just so I'm clear, does it matter when they got their 2,000th strikeout? Because if it does, and they had to have 2,000 before they won, then I would be in trouble, but hopefully not.
No, that's not the case. So just they had a total of 2,000 strikeouts in their playing career. Okay. It doesn't matter when those strikeouts occurred.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
So and it could happen some even point. after the winning the World Series.
Yeah. Got it. Okay, that helps. All right, so there's one more thing, Nick. You're probably familiar with this, but Glanville has decreed that any question with this many answers, meaning four or more, takes you above the Glanville line. So I'm going to throw this to Doug. I ask this every week, I think. How many of these do you think we should have to get for us to say we got the question right?
Well, I liked what we did. I think it was last week, but we said, well, can we do five guesses, four answers, or less guesses and get them all? You know, we kind of thought about that. Uh-huh. So I don't know. I mean, I'm open to ideas. I don't mind, you know, 5 for 4 or something like that. I mean, it could be 7 for 4 since we're talking about World Series here, but that's a little bit much. So yeah, we're trying to figure out where we have some leeway in this whole thing.
All right, let's have Nick tell us.
Yeah.
Nick, what are you comfortable with? You don't have, like you should, you could probably say no. You have to get all four. But then you'll never ask another question. Just so how many do you think we should have to get right?
You know, I think 3 out of 4 would be pretty impressive here.
Yeah,
would
it? Ooh, okay. Yeah. That must be tough.
3 out of 4 right. Would be pretty good.
So we get four guesses, and we only have to get three? Okay, I think we can do that. Mm. Because
it must be hard.
I
don't know. I'm getting suspicious. This must be really hard. He was like, yeah, 3.
And
one
hey,
out of
four.
Get 1 out of 4.
Extra kudos.
I was like, All right.
All right. Okay. Well, I've been to almost all of these World Series since 96.
Yeah.
So I thought of two answers really quick.
Okay.
Randy Johnson, 2001. Mm-hmm. That seemed about as obvious as it gets. And Cole Hamels in 2008. I know he didn't get his 2,000th strikeout until way after that World Series, but Nick just said that doesn't matter. So I think that gives us two.
Don't tell us yet.
Then we just have
Don't
to settle us. On who's left, okay? So Josh Beckett in 2003.
Amazing.
I know he was World Series MVP.
Yeah, because he beat us, I remember.
I think he pitched. Yes, he did. I think he pitched for 15 years. Don't you think that guy got the 2,000
sure.
strikeouts?
Yep.
Think about him.
Okay.
Steven Strasburg,
ooh.
2019. I know he was hurt a lot, but he did have a big strikeout rate when he pitched.
Mm.
So think about that one. The problem is it's not that many seasons, right? Debuted in 2014, I think.
Mm.
No.
He was MVP.
Never mind. 2011. But then he never hardly pitched after 2019. So that's dicey. He missed a lot of time. Tommy
and
John.
He was
okay, I'm going to say he
was
probably
the MVP
did.
Of that year?
Pretty sure he was.
Okay.
I think he was.
All right.
Could be wrong. All right. Madison Bumgarner also came to mind.
Ooh.
But I also thought he was not a huge strikeout guy.
Ooh. I didn't think of Mad Bum.
So think about him. And then one more Doug that I thought of. How about Mark Burley?
Oh, I have him on my list.
Was he the MVP in 2005? I feel like he threw a complete game in game one as a starter, and then he saved the clincher.
Ooh.
So,
man, good one.
You know, it was a pitching-dominated World Series. Just think about that.
Ooh.
But I must be missing somebody.
Did they sweep? How did they? What was
it? It was a sweep.
Yeah,
it was a sweep.
Wow.
So
yeah, that's a good one.
Doug, who are we missing?
All right. You got a lot of my list here. I have Hamels. So here I have more questions. So Randy Johnson, 2001, didn't he save the game and come in relief and do?
He won game six as a starter.
Right. And then
He came in and finished game seven.
Yeah. All right, so that's
and won that game as a reliever when Luis Gonzalez did his thing.
Yep. All right, so that's one name I'm throwing. Now, when the bloody sock with Schilling, was he MVP?
That was the
ALCS.
The
ALCS, okay.
The sock.
So he didn't.
They might have been co-MVPs.
In the World Series?
Might have been, but that would still count.
Okay. All right, so Schilling.
I would count it. If they're both MVPs, then it would make Schilling answer also.
Wait, who?
If they were co-MVPs,
yeah.
That would also make Schilling an answer. But I think Randy was the MVP.
Yeah.
Randy won three of the four games they won.
Yeah, no, I was thinking Schilling in Boston in the World Series. He didn't win MVP ever in the World Series? Schilling?
No. Oh, in his last year with Boston? No. No.
Okay. Now, what about this dude, John Lackey? Didn't he do some wild stuff?
You're talking about 2002?
He's just been around.
His rookie year?
I don't know. He's just been around and.
So much went on in that World Series. He did play a big role. I do not believe he was the MVP.
Not in Boston? I thought he relieved and started.
Oh.
Yeah.
You think of 2013 or something?
I don't know. Somewhere. He wore a lot of that.
I think you're over.
John Lester.
Which World Series?
I don't know. I just throwing his name out there.
definitely was not the MVP in 2016. He did start a game in the 2007 World Series.
I'm glad I got some good answers to make you think about it.
One of the things I was trying to think of was 96 was the cutoff year.
Yeah.
I know that Nick said that was the first year of your career.
Yeah.
And maybe that was why. I also thought it was to keep Tom Glavin from being an answer. But it's also, isn't there Andy Pettit could have been a factor that year?
I thought about Pettit too. Oof, all right.
David Cohn.
I don't know. I mean, I thought Mariano, he didn't have enough strikeouts. So. And then the only other name I thought of, so you said Strasburg, because I thought Scherzer, didn't he relieve? I thought he did something like Randy Johnson did.
Well, that,
like those starters, Corbin too, they pitched in relief. They did all kinds of stuff. Right. I remember Strasburg being the MVP.
Okay.
That's my recollection.
Okay. All right. So we feel good. So Strasburg, Mad Bum, Burley, Lackey, Randy Johnson, Schilling.
Randy and Hamels, I think, are.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
And then Strasburg and Beckett were probably the other two, I would personally guess.
Okay, Strasburg and Beckett. Yeah, Beckett. Yeah, I mean, I think Beckett's a good answer. I don't know. I feel like Burley is a good answer. Did he have 2,000 strikeouts? It's kind of a pitch.
He pitched forever.
He did pitch forever. Okay. All right, so he's saying Randy Johnson. Is that the first name you gave?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. I must have. All right. Randy Johnson. I'm writing this down here. Hamels, right? Beckett.
Right.
And Strasburg.
Or Burley. But we don't know if Burley was actually the MVP.
I don't know.
He just feels like he could be a stumper.
Yeah. You know? Burley and Strasburg. Strasburg, oh boy, what's the issue with Strasburg? You know he was the MVP, right? But
yeah, but think of all the time he missed.
Strikeout totals, yeah.
Right, he had Tommy John.
10 years, 200.
All the injuries.
200 strikeouts.
But he was on the injured list, what, 10 years in a row.
All right, so let's go with Burley. Let's just go with Burley. Burley, Beckett, Johnson, and Cole Hamels.
No. Randy, Hamels, Beckett, Burley?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Let's just guess. Nick, is there any shot that it's Randy Johnson, Cole Hamels, Josh Beckett, and Mark Burley?
So you said Randy Johnson?
Yes.
Josh Beckett?
Yes.
Cole Hamels? Yep.
Yes.
Mark Burley?
Yes.
Fortunately, that is 2 out of 4.
Oh!
It's 2 out of 4?
2 out of 4.
Yeah.
So that means Beckett didn't get there and Burley didn't win the MVP?
Yeah, that's correct. Beckett was really close. He was at 1,900-something strikeouts.
Oh, no.
I know. Almost there.
1,900. Nice.
Yeah, so Randy Johnson, Cole Hamels,
sure. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And who are the two we missed?
So
you were on the right track when you were thinking co-MVP. Kurt Schilling was co-MVP with Randy Johnson in 2001. I thought all the Arizona stuff would give that away. And then the other one was also a former Diamondback, although his tenure with the Diamondbacks is nowhere near as famous as his tenure with the Giants. It is Mad Bum.
Okay, so we named every name as we usually do. But Doug, how do we keep talking ourselves out of the right answer? How do we stop ourselves from doing that?
We didn't really like go off of our, we didn't like talk ourselves out of the first thought. It was just like, there's a lot of good answers here. I was like, Mad Bum, you know, I mean, Mad Bum definitely, but yeah, I guess he did pitch forever, but you know, so did Burley. So who's the MVP of the White Sox 2005?
Jermaine Dye.
Okay, then. Here we go. It was all about the pitching, but Jermaine Dye won the MVP. Hey, look. The good news is, whether we get the questions right or wrong, I remember when we used to get them right. The best part of this segment is a part that we haven't even gotten to yet. That is the part where we get out of the way and we bring in the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster, to play another sensational play-by-play clip involving this week's answer. So, Tim, what do you got for us this week?
I wish I had done more research into Nick's sports fandom, because then I definitely would have gone with the D-backs, but I didn't. Instead, I went with the bad D-back, which is Mad Bum. But what a performance back in the 2014 World Series, beating the Royals and closing it out in Game 7 with 5 scoreless innings. Here's the final out.
Salvador Perez, the 2-2. Popped up. Sandoval in foul territory. Giants win! A World Series win for the San Francisco Giants for the third time in the last 5 years. And their hero, Madison Bumgarner.
Their hero, Madison Bumgarner. Let me just tell you a quick story about that game, okay? So after the game, Bruce Bochy says they never intended for Mad Bum to finish the game. Okay, to pitch all those innings. It just happened. So I saw Dave Righetti afterwards, and I said, Dave, Bosch said that Bumgarner was not supposed to finish the game. How did he wind up finishing the game? And so Dave Righetti says to me, well, we decided if he gets in any trouble at all, we're just going to take him out. I said, really? Because you realize the tying run was on third base when Salvador Perez came up, right? And he said, oh, yeah, but he wasn't going to give up a hit to that guy. So, okay then. So I remember thinking as I was walking back to the press box, he gave up a hit to him the previous at bat. Okay. Anyway, Nick, great work. Great question. Thank you for joining us in Starkville. Please come back again sometime.
Thanks so much, guys. It was a lot of fun.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager. Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB Show.
Strange but true.
Doug, I have been waiting a week to talk about this. We didn't get to it last week. It's one of the epic strange but trues ever. So we're bringing it back in part because I just wrote all about it in a Weird and Wild special at The Athletic a few days ago. So before, just to set it up, let me ask you two quick questions. And just give me a word or two answer. If you get 23 hits in a 9-inning game, you're guaranteed to win. Am I right, Doug?
Yes, you are. It's like there's a rule, actually, in the rule book that once you get 23 hits, you automatically win.
There must be. Yeah. And if you get no hits for 10 innings in a game, it's pretty much impossible to win. Am I right?
It's impossible. The only exception is if there is a zombie apocalypse. And, you know, why would that ever happen in baseball?
That's true. So. That could never happen.
No.
Okay, so as I'm sure you know, those two answers are wrong and wrong. Because last weekend, on back-to-back days, the Red Sox really did get 23 hits in a 9-inning game against the Orioles, and they still lost. So while we're digesting that, the next day, the Yankees got no hits against the Brewers for 10 1/3 innings. But somehow that day, they did this.
3-2. Drilled to left field and deep. Going back is Taylor. It's over his head. And the Yankees will win the game. Everson Pereira scores. It's a walk-off hit for Higashioka. And the wildest, strangest Sunday afternoon, the Yankees go from being no hit for 10 1/3 innings to walking off with a victory.
Wait, what? The Yankees won? Okay, so 23 hits and lose, but no hits and win? Okay, so what do you think, Doug? Did that break the universe to have those things happen in less than 24 hours?
Well, it never breaks the Starkville universe, okay? So that's impossible.
True.
That's the beauty of it. We just grow and adapt and sort of reshape the boundaries that actually don't exist. That's the point. There are no boundaries in Starkville. So we're coming, you know, we're going to annex all your towns out there, by the way, eventually. Well, that's our goal, world and universal domination. But yeah, man, I mean, it just, within the realm of my career in baseball, it seems impossible. I mean, I've seen crazy stuff, certainly. But I mean, 23 hits, you're just like, you know, you're trying to figure out, like, okay, how do we end this game? Maybe we can, like, throw position players just to give them a chance to come back. You're trying to find ways, but, you know, 23 hits is just, that's an automatic. And then to get no hit. Now, yeah, no, there's been some close games. And, you know, I remember it was a Joe Cowley. He had a no-hitter and they had 7 walks. I mean, okay, I can get the 1-0 accident, double no-hitter. But the fact that this, like, went into extra innings and then it almost seemed like the Brewers got blown out. You know, it was like, wait a minute, what happened here?
They gave up a run in every inning. It's like a hit and a run in every inning once they started giving up.
Right, hits. There was, like, mound visits. I was like, what is going on? They didn't use any of them for, like, so it's like, it was literally like 2 games happened. It was just like the tale of 2 cities. And that's perfect for splitting the universe in the world that we live in Starkville. So it was crazy. But that catch, by the way, that was, you know, that was when you were like, oh, the Brewers are absolutely going to win. But once again, it wasn't like they weren't the home team. You have the zombie runners. So it was like, well, wait a minute now. Nothing is finalized when you always have these crazy, wacky extra innings. I mean, you literally, and we were trying to figure out, like, wait a minute, now they could still be no hit and win the game.
Right. Oh, very
so, you know, I'll let you take that part. But
well, they kind of were, sort of. All right. Anyway, you won't be surprised to hear I have some tidbits on those games. So let's just go through to just a very quick rundown. First thing, the Red Sox are not the first team to get 23 hits in a 9-inning game and lose. But they were the first team to do that in 93 years. Okay, the Cardinals did it in 1930 in the infamous Baker Bowl in Philadelphia. Go Google Baker Bowl sometime. The right field fence was 280 feet from home plate, and the league slugged 500 for the season that year. Okay, so that should barely count. But anyway, what do you think the record was since then of all teams that got 23 hits or more in a 9-inning game? Ooh. You want to guess, Doug? You want to just
Well, it's and oh. I'm going to just start there. I don't know the first part of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So how about 241-0? So the Red Sox broke a 241 game winning streak. And I can't even, like, make my brain, like, understand that. A 241 game winning streak is essentially a season and a half of never losing. But then they lost, but a game, they got 23 hits. So that was a good one.
I feel like that streak will continue too, by the way. It's going to start over and, you know, 500.
Yeah, like, one of the fun things is there hadn't even been a game of any length where a team got 23 hits and lost in over 40 years. The last one was a 20-inning game. Okay, so it was hard to do that. But then, all right, the next day we had the Yankees game. Doug, here's an even stranger but truer stat. How many teams in history have taken a no-hitter into the 11th inning and lost, Doug? Would you believe that answer is all of them? Okay, this is true. The Brewers were the fourth team ever to do it, and none of them won the game. So is that the strangest but truest stat ever? It feels like it.
That doesn't make any sense, but I don't know. It's sort of like, is it a curse to have like no hits and then get into extra innings? It sounds like a curse. And when you have zombie apocalypses, right? I mean, these runners come out of nowhere and then they just appear and you can see them. So I guess they're not ghost runners anymore. And then, you know, I would have loved if he stole third, the ball goes in the left field and without a batter even putting the ball in play. Like, that's like, oh my goodness, they threw a no hitter.
We were all set up for that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, you could do it in a quote perfect right. game. We've been through that, right? Exactly. Lost in the middle of all that was there was a Yankees first. Nobody noticed except me. Giancarlo Stanton in the, let me think, the 12th inning. He led off with a two-run game-tying homer. It's the first two-run game-tying homer leading off an inning in the history of the Yankees because, of course, that used to be impossible. But this game proved that nothing is impossible. Nothing. But just for the record, let's just make sure of this. You have never personally done either of those things. Am I right? In any level? Little League, anywhere, been on a team that got 23 hits and lost or on a team that got no hits and won?
Oh, wow. I don't think that's ever happened. I mean, well, Little League was a little weird, though. So I know.
T-ball.
Well, a little fun factoid. I need to find this article. But in high school, I pitched against Ron Valone. He was at Bergenfield. And I got the only hit, I think, of the game, and we won like 1-0, and I threw a no-hitter. It was something like that. So I will look it up to confirm, but it was like back and forth. And so in that case, I think I don't know if we went into extras, but it was just like, okay, I can see that, you know, it reminds me of the Frank Viola, wasn't it Frank Viola, Ron Darling game? He wrote about in the complete game where they, St. John's versus Yale, and they went, like, I think they both threw no-hitters into, like, the 10th, 11th inning. I forgot who won. I think Yale might have won. So, I'll pull that clip and post it once I find it. But, yeah, so weird stuff like that, you know, a little bit more familiar. Maybe in high school you get some strange things in Little League, of course. But, yeah, I've never recalled any game where – first of all, I don't think I was on a team that got no-hit at once in 1992 in A-ball. And that was from a scoring change. We got no hit, but I've never been on a team that got no hit. I never, like, you're talking about professionally, really? And I've never been on a team that threw a no hitter that I can recall either. So that just was not part of my professional life. So I don't know. It's crazy. But 23 hits, no. I mean, the Phillies Cubs game, that 26-23. I don't know, what did that turn out to be? That was
also on this list. Okay. Right.
So yeah. I do remember that game.
You remember that game? That was 19.
No, not remember. I just recall. I remember the box.
You think of that? Are you thinking of the 23-22 game?
Yeah, at Wrigley.
That's a different
with
game.
Mike Schmidt.
Yeah, that's a different game. Okay. There was also a 26-23 game at Wrigley, like 100 years.
Oh, ago. No. The 20.
And that is on that list, but the 23-22 game is not on the list because it was not a 9-inning game.
One extra innings. Yeah, and how many hits did these teams get in that game? I got to look that up.
It wasn't a 9-inning game. Yeah. It doesn't apply.
Yeah. But of any length.
Was it a strange game? Yeah, it was. Okay. It was a really strange game. But look, Doug, you said this a minute or so ago. Baseball makes no sense. And as we have said here many times, that is the best thing about it. Okay. So that is going to do it for this week's show. We'll be bringing you podcast magic just like this all season long on The Athletic Baseball Show, which is available in its entirety, absolutely free, everywhere you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to read any of the tremendous baseball stories we write in The Athletic every day, including me explaining how it's possible to get 23 hits in a game and lose, I can tell you where to do that. Just go to theathletic.com/baseballshow And if you're a new subscriber, you can sign up for a one-year subscription for just $1 a month for the next 12 months. $1! That's what I said, $1. But also remember, you too can be part of this podcast. Every show, we pick some fun listener trivia question. Then that lucky listener gets to join us right here and prove once again, there's almost no baseball trivia question we can't get wrong. So how could you join us? You could always email us at starkville@theathletic.com. You could check out my Facebook fan page. We've gotten quite a few fun questions there this season. Or you can do what Nick Pierce did today. And you could X at us on the site we used to call Twitter. So, Doug, if someone wants to X you a question, is that still doable?
Yeah, right. First of all, I think of Wakanda Forever when you know, the X, that's my first reaction. They apparently need to collaborate on that. I'm still at the same place. I mean, if it's Xing or something, my wife is totally baffled. Like, how do you X somebody? It's already a verb. It's already a term. We can't have that. So anyway, I just put my name in there after the at symbol. I think it still works. DougGlanBille. That's it.
Yeah, I'm at Jason ST, but that's Jason with a Y. So JaysonST. You don't have to spell my whole name like you have to do with Glanville. And just remember, hashtag those questions, hashtag StarkvilleQS. So Doug, thanks for playing. Thanks to Dan Shaughnessy. Thanks to Dan Shaughnessy for visiting us. Thanks to Nick Pierce for the great trivia question. Thanks to the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster, for producing us and putting up with us. And Doug and I will see you next week
on Starkville.
Starkville.